It's time for the Burt Cohen Show. And the dream goes on and sometimes is threatened, depending on your point of view. But every couple of years now, we have elections. Of course, there's the presidential election, but here at home, extremely important election for governor, state senate, and state representatives. And as I'm sure you know by now, Governor Lynch is not running for what would be an unprecedented fifth term. So the future is in your hands. It's in our hands. Democrats, Republicans, independents, it's really important to consider who the candidates are and vote in the primary. And our first guest among the gubernatorial wannabes is Jackie Silly. We hope to have all four of the candidates for governor on the Burt Cohen Show. And as I say, our first guest is Jackie Silly, who is here in the studio with us, and we'll talk for a few minutes. And if you want to call in shortly thereafter, please do ask your questions of candidate for Governor Jackie Silly, 603-430-9722. Jackie, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. For those who don't know, and as the polls have shown, a lot of people don't know, who is Jackie Silly and what makes you qualified to be governor?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on this morning, Bert. And so in terms of who I am, I originally from Berlin, New Hampshire, born and brought up in the North Country, and lived here all my life and have enjoyed every minute of that. Come from a factory town and a factory family. I like letting folks know that my grandfather worked in the Brown Paper Mill Company. My father drove a logging truck for them. Grandmother and mother worked in the Weir Knitters T-shirt factory. So that's, I come very much from a working class background. At the age of 29, I was the first person in my extended family to be able to go on and get a college education. In fact, about half my family had not had the opportunity to finish high school. So education is tremendously important to me. It is what took me out of poverty from a third floor walk-up tenement to having opportunities that I would not have otherwise had. That's going to be an important part of the platform of my administration. And what qualifies me, I've served one term in the House, two terms in the Senate. I have a very, very, and I've also taught for 20 years at the Whittemore School. I've run a business. My husband runs a business. So I have a keen sense of what it's going to take to move this economy forward and the direction that this current legislature, which is an extremely radical legislature, has moved us in, is just absolutely counterintuitive to how you entice businesses, how you grow startups. And we're seeing the impact of that. The metrics are not good.
Yeah, it is certainly is taken a very, very different and unique turn. I never would have expected that. Worked with Democrats and Republicans, and this breed in the House that's running the show there is something else entirely. And I definitely at some point during this show want to ask about what things would look like with either Ovid LaMontagne or Kevin Smith governor. But I want to focus on education. You mentioned how education is extremely important to you. And I was in the state Senate a little bit before you, and we kept dealing with funding education over and over and over and over. And we've never resolved it. What education, as you mentioned, is extremely important, you know, to attract businesses and to have a strong economy. How can we fund education fairly and adequately?
Well, actually, and this was interesting because even the polls showed it. If you look historically at a lot of the polls that have been done by the UNH Survey Center, every year for years and years, when you ask citizens what was on their mind in terms of what was really important to them in terms of government, they would say the funding of education. after the Democrats, and we were only in the majority for 4 years out of about 125.
Yeah.
But after the Democrats, were in the majority, there was a formula put into place. It was actually a bipartisan, they worked very hard and very diligently on this formula, and it was a bipartisan formula. That formula has never actually been put fully into place.
And which formula was that?
It was the formula to fund adequate education. And because there were, it would affect communities, it was a very objective formula with objective elements to it. And as I said, it was bipartisan. But we knew that there would be communities that would be affected in the short term. And as you know, the way communities develop their budgets is in a different cycle than the state. And so there was a collar put on it for the first couple of years. That jerry-rigging of the formula, if you will. That's sort of probably not the term that I want to use, but the manipulation of that formula in order to accommodate the needs of communities and to certainly make sure that it didn't harm communities was carried forward by the current legislature, and I believe it became problematic. So my point being right. that the objective formula passed 3 years ago, 4 years ago now, was never put into place. And I want to come back to the surveys. What's interesting is once we developed that formula, if you look at the surveys from the UNH Survey Center, the concerns about education dropped right off.
Now, why?
I think folks said they've dealt with it. They've put something forward. Everybody's agreed.
And that collar, if you will, was like a collar thinking about, horses pulling or something like that so that it would be not too much burden, I guess. It was a temporary kind of restraint. And did it or deal with the problem that we have here in the Seacoast, the donor towns issue? Because a lot of people are concerned that our tax dollars could flow elsewhere, even to wealthy towns. People have been concerned about that. Or why didn't this go into effect, and how maybe you can say more about what the collar is?
Well, the collar was, as I said, to prevent any so that the communities that had their budgets fully developed wouldn't suddenly be told, okay, you're not going to get the dollars that you were going to get. So that was supposed to see them through, and that was supposed to come off. Then it was supposed to come off and go to the full formula sometime in the couple of years after it was passed in the House and the Senate. I think it was about 4 years ago, five years ago now. That has not been done. So we've never seen the formula fully put into effect.
Why?
I can't explain why, except that this legislature chose not to.
So
they spent a lot of time really just basically trying to figure out how to defund education completely. That could explain some of it. That they were much more fixated on how to take dollars away. Then worry about how to allocate them efficiently and effectively and where they were needed.
So,
as you know, they actually went after twice in the last 2 years. I think twice they've gone after a constitutional amendment that, in my estimation and that of many others who care about education, these constitutional amendments, there's a couple of things I would say about them. First and foremost, when they talk about, it'll allow you to target money
right.
to school districts that need it the most, we can already do that. But the law says that first we fund adequate education, then we can target any dollar over that we'd like to. And of course, that means more dollars. So that has people concerned. But constitutional amendments are about whether we fund your school or your school or your school. My administration will be about how we partner with the communities to fully fund education in the state of New Hampshire in an effective, efficient manner, not looking to waste dollars here, but an effective, efficient manner that ensures that every child in this state has an opportunity at a good education. And I say that for several reasons. As I mentioned, education took me out of poverty.
Right.
It's done so for thousands of our citizens. We don't leave anybody behind. Education should not be an accident of geography. Our young people absolutely need to have the tools necessary to compete with all of the other states around us and with China and India. And if we can't do that, that's the underpinning of our economy.
It's amazing to me that that it might be possible to underfund education. And as you said in your words, whether, not how much, but whether or not your town gets funding. Because as I understand it, and I've been out of the legislature, thankfully, I will say, for a few years, and haven't always followed things as closely. But it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that some of the ideas that have been talked about are allowing the state to simply not fund education at all.
Absolutely. If you think about what this legislature has done, and just coming back to the constitutional amendment for a moment, it has been defeated this time.
Right.
But if this group gets back in, they will continue to try. This is one of their driving items of their agenda. I was saying to somebody the other day, this allows education funding to become a political football. Mm. Think of who is at O'Brien. Speaker O'Brien, one of the best-known Republicans in the state right now and the least liked,
yes,
the absolute least liked, how much power he has to determine which school will get funding and how much they'll get. This is a man who has manipulated his own troops, the people who serve for him. If he doesn't like what they do, he removes them from their chairmanships. He's called Bully O'Brien for a reason.
Sure.
So think about putting education funding in the hands of somebody like that, and with a constitutional amendment that removes oversight from the courts, that allows education funding to become political football. Who has the power? Where does the money go?
We'd love to hear from you at 603-430-9722. Our guest today is candidate for governor Jackie Silley. At 603-430-9722, call us in with your questions. And this, where we just left off, brings up the different vision that there would be with either a Kevin Smith or an Ovid LaMontagne. Assume, I hate to, but if Bill O'Brien is still in power and we have a governor Kevin Smith or an Ovid LaMontagne, paint a picture, if you would, if you can stand it.
I would rather think that he will not be in power. I'd rather think that he has other things to do with his life after November. Kevin Smith and Ovid LaMontagne have gone to the State House repeatedly to tie themselves to the O'Brien agenda, whether it's the constitutional amendment on education, the constitutional amendment forever banning an income tax, or consideration, or the thought of, or the ability to speak about, certain revenue streams. They have gone up there and testified for the right to work for less bill that every other Republican and Democratic governor and legislature has vetoed, because they know what the story of right-to-work states are. They have a lower medium wage. They have lower health care for their citizens. They have more accidents. I mean, the metrics in right-to-work states are not good. And every other Republican and Democratic administration throughout our history, for the last 30 years, I think, this bill has been brought forward, and it has been defeated. Kevin Smith and Ovid LaMontagne have testified in favor of that bill. I believe that they testified in favor if not the elimination, the weakening of collective bargaining. They have been up to the State House numerous, numerous times, tying themselves to the Bill O'Brien legislature. So if he makes it back in and one of them becomes governor, I think what we've seen over the last 2 years, in fact, Ovid LaMontagne said he wants to be Scott Walker on steroids. I think that's what we see, is a legislature and our own version of Scott Walker. This is not mainstream New Hampshire. This is not where I was brought up. This is not what we stand for. I've talked to many, many Republicans that are proud of that name. They don't want to give it up. They feel their party's been co-opted, and I agree with them.
And I have to say, I talked to a lot of people in this area, Republicans, who feel that they're conservative Republicans, but they don't recognize what this party has become. It's something else entirely.
Well, there's a reason for that. I mean, most of them are extreme libertarians, and there are also, there's a heavy influence of the free state agenda in, yes, our state now, and they were very serious about taking us over and making us in their likeness.
And just briefly, and there may be some listeners who aren't familiar with the free staters.
Free staters were invited here by Craig Benson. The Free State Project was one that there were followers around the country, and they decided that if they could move to a small enough state that had an open enough government, they could actually take it over and force their agenda. And you can go on their website. It's the Free State Project. And they make no bones about they do not believe in government. And it's all well and good to talk about government as though it's some big amorphous bedbug. But that's not what government is. Government is us. We've come together. A civilized society comes together and decides what services is it that our citizens want and need. What services do businesses want and need? When you talk about government as though it's only entitlement programs, because oftentimes when I talk to somebody who's very conservative, that's where they start. And I say, well, wait a minute. Who do you think's filling the potholes out there? Who's building that bridge? Have we got a little problem over here with bridges lately?
Yeah,
literally. And part of that is because those should be maintained. Our infrastructure, we cannot all get out there and tar our own little patch of the road or pave or cement our own little sidewalk. That's our government in action. And the infrastructure under our city streets that's deteriorating, by the way, that's government. The person who's out there plowing snow at 3 o'clock in the morning so that you and I can get up and go to work, that's government. Our businesses rely on the services that are provided as much as our citizens do. So when we keep reducing, as Grover Norquist likes to talk about, reducing government to the size where we can shrink it and drown it in the bathtub, that makes for a really poor society and a poor standard of living, and businesses don't want to come here. And that's exactly what's happening lately. We're finding more and more businesses do not want to come to New Hampshire because they see us as unwilling to invest in the very things they need to be able to do business. So who's attracting them? The most taxed state in the country, New York, Massachusetts.
Wow.
Do you know one out of five of our workers works in a different state?
One out of five.
87,000 work in Massachusetts, 11,000 work in Maine, 6 work in Vermont. I have 8 grandchildren in this state. If they want to stay here, I want them to have an opportunity to live and work and make a living in this state.
Well, we are talking again with candidate for governor Jackie Cilley. Our phone number here is 603-430-9722. And I have to say, when I was in the state senate representing this area throughout the 1990s, and Pease had closed and it was empty, there was nothing there. We wanted businesses to come. One of the absolute essentials was to have an infrastructure and schools, because businesses are families. They want to bring their kids up in a good school. And unless we had a good highway system that was reliable, and I can't remember the commissioner of transportation's name during that period, but what he said about our bridges was, drive fast and don't look back.
Wasn't that Bartholomew's when he took over the temporary? I can't remember.
It was the prior one, but our bridges need attention. They do, and you can't have businesses without things like that.
Well, I was reading a comment from a woman actually over in Salem about talking about there was the Memorial Bridge or the Sarah Long Bridge, and she said it's a little like a car that needs to have oil and needs to have oil changed. You take care of it. You maintain it. And when you don't, you pay the price. And that's when we've got 37% of our bridges red-listed.
Yes.
And red-listed means they are dangerous in some to some extent or another. 46% of our roads in disrepair. And by the way, we all pay for that. $263 per vehicle in readjustments, realignments, busted tires or hubcaps, whatever. We pay for that.
That's true.
So, you pay one way or the other.
That's a very interesting point. We pay one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the illustrious name of Grover Norquist. Something called the Pledge. The Pledge has been in New Hampshire politics, my goodness, since probably the 70s, I guess. I don't know when the union leader first created it. But there's been the Pledge. And Grover Norquist has his own pledge that he's got the Republican Party...
there are actually several now. So we have the old Meldon Thompson, William Loeb pledge to that anybody who ran for statewide office would veto any broad-based tax forever ad nauseum. We have the Grover Norquist pledge that he dreamed up at the age of 12. So we know every 12-year-old is... I had 12-year-old sons. I know how brilliant they were at the time. So we have a 12-year-old boy's... version of, you know, never, ever, ever raising taxes, even if that means getting rid of loopholes. Then we have the Americans for Billionaires Prosperity Pledge. I mean, we now have lots and lots of pledges, and the folks over in our current state house have taken most of them. But that has been the litmus test,
right,
from which each party really has right. fielded candidates and said, okay, you've got to take the pledge because that's how you get elected.
Right.
I have said I will not take pledges. I, for one thing, those kinds of pledges say to the citizens of this state, I'm not listening. I'm not listening. You can talk about it. I have a pledge not to talk about it. You would not hire a carpenter and have that carpenter show up at your house, put down his or her toolbox, and take out that hammer, that saw, that measuring tape, and say, I have a pledge not to use those. You'd send that carpenter packing. And just think about what you do with a doctor that pulled out a few tools that said, you know, I have a pledge not to use them. Taking pledges is not leadership, nor is it governing. And I am proud to say, today, sitting here, in the last 3 weeks, I am seeing such support for that position. First of all, there have been courageous Republicans that have stepped up and said, enough, enough with pledge politics. So Jeb Bush, Lindsey Graham, never accused of being liberals, either one of them, have said, stop taking pledges. The No Labels group that got a lot of fame a couple of years ago, they have said, they've asked everybody that's connected with them to call on their congressmen and senators and say, no more pledges. They have made it very clear you cannot govern. You can't govern when you take these pledges.
Well, that brings up the question of there's politics and there's government. When you're running for office, it's politics. But when you're in office, it's government. Two very, very different...
Well, governing, I think, is what...
Governing, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Serving the people, you know. So that's a position on governing as to doing the best job for the state of New Hampshire and our economy. People have said, and you've heard this probably more times than you can count, but you can't get elected unless you take the pledge. Have we ever elected a governor who hasn't taken the pledge? Your primary opponent, Maggie Hassan, has taken the pledge. I understand she says, well, in order to get elected, you have to take the pledge. What's your response to that?
Well, I've got a couple. Number one is that I want people to understand the kind of governor that I will be. So there'll be no etch-a-sketch moment here. I have absolutely no interest. I want them to see who I am as a candidate and understand who I plan to be as a governor. And that means making sure that all options are on the table and that we can use whatever tools are necessary and understand. And there are friends on, you know, even within my party that like to get out there and say, oh, well, Jackie Silly hasn't taken a pledge. That means she's for, and they'll name, you know, our revenue source. That's not true. It's not true. And Foster's recognized it when I met with them last week, and they came out with a very, very kind op-ed yesterday where they said there's no smoke and mirrors with Jackie Silly. That, you know, this is somebody who's open-minded, who wants to have that conversation, who will listen to everything. And what I have said to people, and you know I'm out at several events a day,
right,
we talk about looking for a plan that fits the traditions and the culture of New Hampshire, allows us to position this state for the 21st century marketplace, allows us to be competitive and attract businesses, and starts to reduce that property tax burden that's killing our citizens.
Well, one concern I've had is that, okay, Jackie Silly says she's against the pledge. Well, what is Governor Silly going to do about finding new revenue? We have, you know, every state is in a difficult fiscal situation right now. We're still in a recession. So, you know, do we continue to cut? Do we look for cuts in the state government? Or how can we meet our revenue obligations?
First of all, you start with, and I know that many folks think this is the sort of the rhetoric, but it is actually, I've been in office, so I know that,
yes,
there are places that we can make more efficient and effective, and that's not campaign rhetoric. We already know the Pew Institute has looked at us very, very carefully and said there, you know, we might like to think we're fiscally conservative. We are often fiscally foolish. If you go to governor and council on any given Wednesday, you see some of the highest paid officials in our agencies and departments sitting there waiting for their $5,000 grants. Now, that's not a very efficient or effective use of their time. You know, so there are ways. I the first order of business for me is I want to be able to look at our citizens and say, you have the most efficient, effective set of services that any state can deliver. And there are other states who have learned to do it a bit better than us. And those are the states. I mean, you look at Utah, for example. They have a strategic plan. They have measurement reviews. They look at every dime that an agency wants. What are they going to do with it? How is that going to move their society forward? How are they going to address the issues that face that state? And then when they come back the next year, you say, okay, how did you spend it? You know, did you accomplish what you told us you'd accomplish? Those sorts of things. Those are business practices. Those are common business practices. And I know from having run a business, I know from teaching business leaders all over the state, that's just, you know, as I said, it's a common business practice. So that's the first order of business, to ensure that what we have is efficient and effective. I intend to bring frontline troops. You know, we've got 10,500 state employees. You think they see what's going on every day of the week? They ought to be at the table. They delivered $50 million in savings last year, only to be called by this legislature parasites. They delivered $50 million worth of savings, only to be told by this legislature they were going to pay more for their retirement, which had become problematic because of past legislatures. So, or underfunding by past legislatures. So you bring the brightest minds and you bring your frontline troops to the table for this kind of discussion on how you move the state forward in the most efficient and effective manner possible. Beyond that, we are already beginning to convene. I'm having meetings with economists, for example. We are going to be convening panels that are a mixture of businesses, economists, finance people, and taking a good look at everything to determine how we do this in a responsible, respectful manner that's fair to our citizens. Because I don't believe, not for one second do I believe, that we have to be the kind of state that looks at their children and says, sorry, in New Hampshire, we've got to settle for second best.
Well, we are talking, and this is with Jackie Cilley, Democratic candidate for governor. Our phone number here is, and this is a rare opportunity for my listeners to have somebody in the studio where we can take your calls. Take them now at 603-430-9722. What are your questions for Jackie Cilley? Don't hold back. She can handle it. One thing around here is property taxes are of concern. And, you know, I know this is going back a little bit, but taxes are often the center of, like, every campaign. And you get a lot of towns in the state of New Hampshire where the property taxes are really, really high. What has been the effect on the state of New Hampshire, this pledge against any new source of revenue? I mean, we have broad-based taxes. Let's face it here. The property tax is a broad-based tax. It's just
and every business knows. We've got an income tax. It's called the business enterprise tax. We've got sales taxes and so on. I'd like to share a personal story that I heard last week. I was in a store and I was introduced to one of the store clerks named Barbara. And I said to Barbara, what would you like to see in your next governor? And she said, oh, my God. She said, somebody who will honestly face and tackle the property tax burden. And while she was talking, the sadness came over her. She looked, to me, to be a bit younger than I was. She was a grandmother. She had four grandchildren, but a young grandmother. And she told me the story of how she had lost her husband 7 years ago. So she was also a very young widow. Then her eyes welled up. And she told me the story of the home that they had built together, that they had raised their children together in, that they had built a life together in. And what she didn't have to say is that it was the last link she had to him. And she's losing it. She has now paid 10 times the value of the house that was built. So that's an immoral position to put our citizens in. We're one of the top five aging states in the country. And those stories, and I hear it from ministers, those stories are repeating themselves over and over and over again. A woman loses her husband. She then loses his Social Security. She then loses the home that they built together. That's part of their life together. But the other end of the spectrum is just as hard hit. It is a disincentive. Our high property taxes, which, by the way, before this legislature started, were the third highest in the country.
Wow.
By the time they've gotten done, because what they've done, needs never go away. So a lot of things have now been downshifted to the communities that were never downshifted before.
Right.
And they're going to have to pick the full tab up for them. As a result, we had one of the third highest property tax burdens in the country as of a couple of years ago. I could pretty much guarantee we are moving into second or first place by the time everything they've done goes into full effect, that we'll pay, you know, we are, as I said, already one of the highest. That's a disincentive for young people to come here and to buy homes and to stay. So what do we see? We now have the lowest in-migration pattern since the 1950s. Now, it would be, I'm sure that, you know, that there are folks out there that would say, we got enough people living here now, we don't need any more. But here's the kicker. The in-migration pattern always fed our labor force. They were the young moving in. They were the more mobile. They brought new skills with them. It was one of the reasons we were able to attract businesses to our state. We're down to 1950s levels. Half of our counties have actually lost population. So what does that mean? We don't have that young blood. We don't, as we age, we are going to find it more and more difficult to find the services that we need as an aging population. And businesses have taken notice, and they have slowed down, if not stopped. We were at 0.3% gross state product rate of growth. They're going other places, and so are those young people.
So when others talk about, there's too much regulations, if we just do away with regulations, then businesses will come, that's not necessarily why businesses don't come, apparently.
Oh, you've been in the legislature, and so have I. Who have been the largest group of advocates for certain types of regulation? It's been businesses themselves. They know when they're harmed with, you know, so there have been, there's much of the regulation that's been brought into place has been brought by businesses itself.
That's true.
Having sat on the Rules Committee, and you know how enjoyable that is, and I was on it for 4 years, and that means you read every line of every rule written for every bill that's ever been passed in the state. I would never disagree with anybody who said we ought to scrutinize those rules very carefully. There were plenty that I found that I said, these are confusing. Mm-hmm. This makes it more difficult to do business here. But this business of, you know, you take an axe and you say, just get rid of it.
Right.
With no leadership, no insight, no understanding of how this affects our businesses, our consumers. Take the FRM scandal, for example. There were a few people really, really harmed in that, to the tune of, I think it was around $87 million, if I remember correctly, but it was millions that our citizens were bilked because there were holes in the regulations that protected consumers against the very things those people did.
Right.
And they're criminals.
And a lot of people got hurt by that, for sure.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that one of the things that government is, as you said, government is us. And, you know, we have to have a fair playing field anyway. This is not a free-for-all. It's like, you know, if you have a football game, you got to have some rules.
Well, not according to free staters or extreme libertarians. They sort of love that free-for-all. They figure you can take care of yourself. And, if you know, with enough ammunition and enough guns, you can basically take care of anything you need. That's not the way most of us envision taking care of society and taking care of one another.
Again, give us a call, 603-430-9722. We talked about a woman who has, she was widowed fairly young age. And one political reality is that there's two candidates for governor right now, two women Democratic candidates about similar age. People see two. I've heard this from other people. There's two middle-aged Democrat women running.
Oh, that's cruel, Bert.
Well, you got to be at least 40, right?
Yeah, at least.
Okay. And I think Maggie probably is, too. So what's the difference between you two?
There are a number of things that I think distinguish our backgrounds, for example. I mean, I just explained to you what my background was. Right. I don't think that anybody knows the story of working class needs and Main Street businesses the way I do. I've talked about my background of being brought up in a factory town and a factory family. I've also mentioned that I taught probably 3,000 of our business leaders today at the Whittemore School while I was there. I've run a business. My husband runs a business. Two of our sons run businesses. I know what Main Street businesses need. So I think I can speak to authority with that. I also have a fundamental disagreement that we can address our needs by reinstating 10 cents a pack for cigarettes and with gambling money. I don't see that that's going to be the answer to our fiscal issues and our ability to build a sustainable economy moving forward. So what I'm looking for is something that is sustainable, that has a positive impact on our citizens, and relieves the property tax burden at the same time.
And taking the pledge, we've seen what it does to the property tax burden. Over and over and over again.
But I just don't see it as leadership. I don't see it as leadership, and I don't see it as independence. I will not. If there's anything that folks who know me know about me, is that I am extremely independent. I may be a Democrat, but I have always been able to think for myself. So I don't need to sign any pledges to anybody else, long dead men, or 12-year-old boys. I think pretty independently, and so I just don't see the need to have to take those kinds of pledges in order to govern. And that's the kind of thing that I want folks to know about me, and what my administration will be like. It's going to be an extremely independent, governing body and administration.
And that's true. While I was not in the state Senate at the same time you were, you certainly had a reputation for being independent.
I do.
No question about that. One of the things that has come up is gambling. You know, a lot of people, especially around here, are concerned. We have Pease, we have some big hotels. They're concerned about gambling. And neither you nor your primary opponent, Maggie Hassan, are opposed to gambling per se. Tell us about the differences between you two on the issue of gambling.
I don't have any plan for gambling. What I've said is, just like everything else, it's on the table. But it has three major caveats. If you think about the way gambling dollars, well, the very first thing that I would say about gambling is that if you look around the country, it is in trouble. It's everything has a life cycle curve where it's born, it grows up, it gets mature, and ultimately it dies off. So 43 states have allowed expanded gambling.
Wow.
The market's pretty well saturated. So the last figures that I saw, and they're almost a year old now, is that expanded gambling in New Hampshire might contribute $45 million to $100 million in revenues for the state. That is not chump change. If that's possible, then it can contribute something to the coffers. But we're seeing a lot of distress with Foxwoods. They're in trouble. They've had to restructure. Mohegan Sun has had to restructure. Las Vegas is in trouble. First and foremost, you look at the entire industry and you say, okay, what have you got to gain from it? And then what are the problems with it? And one of the things that we know is that the benefits of gambling typically go to the state and the state coffers. The problems with gambling redound to the local level. So it's been very clear to me in traveling around the state, there are places such as the Seacoast, such as Franconia and Sugar Hill, they don't want it. They don't want it. And they should have a say in their destiny. Nothing like that should be foisted on them. On the other hand, Salem, Hudson, and Pelham, they want it. Their selectmen have testified for it. Their chief of police testified for it. Their Lutheran minister testified for it. So they should have some say. You wouldn't want them saying what you had to or couldn't have here on the Seacoast. They should have some say in their own destiny. That said, first of all, any kind of expanded gambling needs adequate oversight. And Massachusetts really struggled with that. I think in the last couple of weeks, they finally got an oversight committee in together. And I think that it says something that it took them so long to do it. And then lastly, for me, it has to have a Chinese wall between that industry and its ability to buy legislative influence. And we already, as far as I'm concerned, and you know the Supreme Court just came out with another case. It was like sort of Citizens United Take Two, I think they called it, where they're allowing even more money to flow into the coffers. I have said I will not take 10 cents of gambling money, not 10 cents. And I've made that very clear to my team that we are not to accept contributions from gambling interest. And I'm proud to say that, so that when it comes to the table, I can look at it with a very clear eye and not have to worry that anybody is concerned about whatever influence that it has on me. And I'm not sure every other candidate can say that.
And I will ask when Maggie Hassan comes in here about the fact that I believe it's her finance director, finance chair, an old friend of mine, Jim Demers, but one of his clients is Millennium, which is a really big corporate gambling interest. And I want to ask her about the influence of Millennium and how powerful they could become over the legislature if suddenly they have all this new power. I think most of us, Democrat, Republican, and Independent, like to believe we have some, you know, it's a citizen legislature here. That's one of the greatest things about New Hampshire is that we get to govern ourselves. And we have some powerful
This is why I am so proud of my campaign. You know, we are not high rollers. If you looked at our financial reports last week, I mean, there are people that are going to say, does she have the financial wherewithal to make it? The answer to that is yes. If they look at when those contributions came in, and by the way, it was $175,000. It got misprinted in a lot of papers because we had two PACs, and we moved from one to the other just because it, you know, we kept the name of the campaign and all. But if you merge the two PACs, $175,000, still well below, the campaign coffers of others. But that's all New Hampshire citizen money. I mean, 98%, 98.7% of that money is all from our citizens. And if you look at, you know, you look at where it came from, you look at when it came in, we started to really, we retrenched in March, and it took about 3 to 4 weeks to get the team we really wanted in place. And it is an amazing team. It's just a talented, passionate, willing to work 16, 17-hour days, day after day after day. They've got me running 17, 18, 19-hour days. I mean, it's just what a talent pool. I mean, led by Liz Mary, who is just an amazing woman. She was a former state legislator. She has been an international business consultant around the world. She knows how to put a team together. She knows how to get the best out of everybody. And I'm just tremendously excited. So it is a community-based campaign. We are running it the way I'd like to see government run. Yeah. Every dime that we raise is put to a very strategic use and to a really good purpose.
Again, we're talking with candidate for governor, Jackie Sillie. Give us a call here at 603-430-9722. And do we have a call now? Yes, we do. Let me punch up a few buttons here and see if we can get that. Are you there?
Hello.
Yes. You're talking to Bert Cohen here, and Jackie Sillie's on the line. What's your question?
Hi, Bert. Hi, Jackie. Thank you for taking the question.
Hi.
One of the things that I often think about when I think about elected politicians is how they view things that go on in our community on a regular basis that are more or less taken for granted, but in my opinion are kind of root causation for some of the systemic problems we have, namely overspending on defense and putting resources into things like nuclear submarines and these huge bombers that fly tremendous amounts of fuel across the sky to perhaps support some, you know, foreign imperial empire that we've got going. And I think these crucial questions really don't get answered or put on the table before candidates such as yourself. I just wanted to know philosophically, as a governor, how you would feel about maybe taking a look at how we could rearrange our priorities. And for instance, when BRAC comes along and says base realignment and closure, all of the politicians don't run down to the Navy Yard and say, we've got to save this, because what are we saving? We're saving nuclear toxic submarines that are a threat to the planet, and I'd like to know how you feel about these things.
All right, well, thanks very much for the call, and of course, she's running for governor, not Congress, so in terms of the, I mean, those are largely federal budget items, but perhaps you can respond.
No, but I think what you saw was Governor Lynch stand strong to try to retain that base here. That provides an awful lot of jobs for our citizens, and we do have certain needs for national defense. If that had gone away, I think the nearest, I actually think it would have been further away than Norfolk, but it would definitely, it was at least that far down that we would have had any facility to be able, because they got rid of all the ones in Maine, right, is my recollection.
Yeah.
So we would not have had facilities anywhere near the area to take care of our military equipment and the subs. I understand what he's saying. You're right. A lot of that is federal. But I think that there is a place and a purpose for the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. It has a long, strong tradition, and that would be something that I would expect to continue to support.
Again, give us a call, 603-430-9722. Thanks very much for that call. And one of the things at the shipyard is the workers up there. It's a strong union place. The sheet metal workers, good bunch of folks, hardworking. They really know their stuff. And one of the factors about this race between you and the other Democrat running has been the race for union support. And you've done pretty well in terms of getting union support, the State Employees Association, which is part of the SEIU. But isn't New Hampshire largely really not a union state?
No, you're right. I think it's about 7%, and I think most of that is in the public sector. But let me say, first of all, that I am so proud and humbled by the endorsement of the SEA. They went through a very long and very detailed vetting process of who we were as candidates, what our ability to win would be, what relationship we saw ourselves having with them, and they did it so thoroughly that I was in Northfield at Old Home Days this past weekend.
Oh, that's always fun.
Well, it's my husband's hometown. We weren't going to miss that one, I can promise you. And so I couldn't believe the number of state employees that I met up in that area that just said, "We endorsed you. I endorsed you. You've got my vote. I want to sign." So it wasn't sort of this leadership endorsement. Uh-huh. The members all know it, and they've got a sense of me. I mean, we both did, we both did videos, and those videos were sent out to all of the membership. And so one of the things we heard over and over again on Saturday is, "You get it. You've walked in my shoes. You know what it's like to work." And the other thing I would say about them is they're really excited to partner, to say, "We want to help make this state." Remember, these people are all taxpayers. You know, I don't know where somebody got the idea that they take their money and run and what, live in a cave? They don't. They're all taxpayers, and they shop Main Street stores, and they help build our economy. So I'm proud of those endorsements. We have we just announced the bricklayers. And those are working men and women. They're my kind of folks. But we are also attracting business leaders as well. And we've had a number of events with them. I hope to, you know, that we are going to be rolling out some endorsements of business leaders.
All right. And it looks like we have another call here. Oops. Yeah, I got to turn. All right. Let's see if that works here. Oh, he's going to try again? Okay.
Did you lose that?
Yeah, I may have lost that, but hopefully he'll try again. Ooh, my error. I got to remember to turn. Yeah, well, oops. We are talking, hopefully asking some decent questions thus far and bringing out who the candidate is. And I'm certainly going to open this up to both Democrats and Republicans running for governor. And why should people vote in a primary? A lot of times, that, as you know, the turnout in a primary is like less than 20% of those who could vote come out and vote. And a lot of people say, "Oh, I don't need to vote in a primary."
They absolutely need to vote in a primary. And here's why. This is where the choices get made. Once that primary is over, you're down to two candidates, you know, basically carrying the flagstaffs of their parties oftentimes. There are some clear choices on both sides of the aisle as well. I can speak to, you know, to my side of the aisle. The Republicans can decide how clear those choices are on theirs. I don't see it quite as much. But there are clear choices. And if folks believe that they want somebody who's independent, who will listen to what they're saying, who will lead, who will govern, then they have a choice on this side of the aisle, and that primary is absolutely critical.
And the date of the primary this year?
The date of the primary is September 11th, I believe.
Yes, it is. An easy date to remember, yeah. Unfortunately.
But, yes.
But September 11th is happens to be the first Tuesday after the first Monday in September, and that's when it gets scheduled.
And get out there and exercise, you know, one of the most important rights that you have as a citizen, and that's to vote. And obviously, I'm asking for your vote. I hope that you will join what is an absolutely exciting team to bring this all the way home.
And again, give us a call. Sorry, I made that error before, 603-430-9722, and talk directly with candidate for governor, Jackie Cilley, and we hope to have, we will have other candidates for governor on as well.
While we're talking about some of the issues, I mean, we were talking about the economy and, you know, pledge politics, all of that stuff. I also want to point out that this legislature and just in terms of their extremism and their being totally outside of the mainstream of New Hampshire.
Yes.
They have gone after education in ways that are simply astounding. 57 bills that would have dismantled our public education. They do not
57.
Believe.
57.
That was just in the first year. There were more coming in the second. But that was to dismantle public education. They simply don't believe in public education.
Right.
And in fact, Senator Forsyth said that that education is not a right, it's an entitlement. He put that in the entitlement bucket, that you should educate your own children at home, you should send them to a religious school or a private school. There's sort of no, even if you wanted to debate the morality of that, there was no understanding and awareness that with the rising level of education in this country in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, that was how our middle class was expanded, and that's how we built our society. They want to go all the way back to the cave days. The war on women has been, I mean, I knew that when they started coming after Planned Parenthood, because they testified, Rich DiPentima, who's a great rep from the Seacoast here, and asked the seminal question. He asked one of the sponsors of the bill, he said, do you consider birth control abortion? And the sponsor said yes. So it was very clear they were coming back, and they did come back after that this year. They have a very particular vision of where a woman ought to be. It's not my vision, and I don't think it's the vision of most women in the state of New Hampshire. So they've done that. So it's education, our women, our workers, and certainly services that citizens and businesses need just in our environment. I mean, our environment, they absolutely would dismantle every environmental regulation that they could if they were able to. And this is why primaries also matter. What they did in the last election cycle was they washed out some of the most rational, reasonable Republicans that I had the pleasure to work with when I was in the House and
yes,
the Senate.
Yes.
And they put in their place extreme libertarians and free staters so that when the general election came, it was only a choice between an R and a D, but the R's were not the R's you and I remember ever having in the state of New Hampshire. They were not the Walter Petersons or the, you know, John Winants or the Stiles Bridges of New Hampshire. This was an extremely different group. So it's just another piece of information that says primaries are extremely important.
And I got to tell you, as I mentioned, I keep talking to conservative Republicans who they can't stand what they've seen happen to their party, and it's not their party. And these are people with whom, I mean, there were people who I always thought, oh, man, you can't get much more to the right than these guys. But even now they are amazed at what's going on. And the way to answer that is not to wait till November.
No.
It's to vote in the primary.
And to step up. One of the things that we're saying on the Democratic side of the ticket, and I can't speak to the Republican side, is that I have never seen as many people step up early, start raising money, start getting the resources, start putting their teams together very, very early to make a credible run. But make no mistake, this state is targeted. There's going to be a ton of money dropped on our heads. We are going to do this. But I what I say to everybody I talk to is think about Egypt. They didn't have a favorable media. They didn't have a favorable press on their side. They sure didn't have a government on their side. They didn't have the resources, the money. They took their country back. They took their country back, and they did it by telling the truth, by informing others on social media. We use the tools at our disposal. You know, Governor O'Malley was up here for the New Hampshire Democratic Convention, and he said something so powerful. It's one of those statements that I like to make every day in every way. He said, "The truth doesn't need to be defended. She only needs to be stated." And as long as we're willing to continue to state that truth, every single time we see a lie and we see a misrepresentation or we see myth opposed as fact, I don't care what paper or what media it's on, we need to tell our citizens the truth.
And again, we have time for perhaps one more phone call, 603-430-9722. You're listening to The Burt Cohen Show. Our guest today is the first candidate for governor that we'll have on the show, Jackie Sille. John Lynch was a real popular governor, Republican and Democrat.
He's going out more popular even now.
That's true.
I think his latest ratings, another radio interviewer said he's at 78%. I'll take their word for it. But it's amazing. It's just amazing.
So how would you be similar or different?
Listen, I've asked a lot of citizens, you know, what is it that, you know, that makes Governor Lynch so popular? And why do you like him so much? And the one common theme that I hear over and over and over again is he shows up. He shows up. He's there. He's accessible.
True.
When I served District 6, I think you'll hear the same thing about me. Wherever I was invited.
Now that was Rochester.
The Rochester, Somersworth, Barrington, Madbury, Nottingham. At the time, the district has changed.
Right.
But I went where I was asked to go. I mean, when citizens wanted to meet or they asked me to participate in fundraisers or whatever, I turned the job into as much fun as I could, but at the same time, very, very seriously, you know, represented them. And so I would build on that tradition of showing up. That's, what do they say about that? It's three quarters of the job. Beyond that, we are very different people. I come from a marketing and an educational background. I intend to use those tools to bring the story of New Hampshire, what has made us great, where we are now, why we have to turn things around, and we cannot allow ourselves to fall into the dustbin of history. And I intend to bring that all around the state. I intend to show our citizens in every single way that I can, and I'm already thinking about a program to do that, of how we're going to be in the departments and in the agencies, and we're going to show our citizens what those government jobs that they talk about as though, you know, we don't need them. I want people to understand what those folks do for each of us as citizens and for our businesses. And do they really want to see that go away? I don't think so. And when you take it down to that elemental level, you see citizens actually really agreeing with you a whole lot.
And the slogan of the campaign was something about granite. What was it now?
Granite tough, New Hampshire proud.
Granite tough, New Hampshire proud.
Yeah,
I like that. I do, I have to say.
Well, it's just, you know, a reporter asked me, well, what do they mean by granite tough? I said, it was the word that kept coming up in the preliminary work that we did on, when you decide, are you the right candidate? Can you get the message across and all? And they just kept saying, tough as nails. And they meant it in a very, very positive way, that I will not back down. When I'm carrying the ball for our citizens, I'm passionate about it. This isn't an electoral ladder. This isn't a resume builder. I've got a nice life. I've got other things I could be doing with my time. But I am really passionate about this state and about the quality of life in this state and my grandchildren's ability to live here, thrive, raise their families, work here, run businesses here. So granite tough, yeah, probably applies.
And the website is?
JackieSille.com.
JackieSille.com.
And that's C-I-L-L-E-Y. And I will tell you that because in the last election cycle, the other side made a few jokes about my name.
Oh,
we are taking that name back. I showed up in Walpole last week, and they had made buttons. A whole group of these folks had made buttons that said, I'm a silly guy, and it's C-I-L-L-E-Y, and we are taking that name back, and we're going to make sure, because that name goes back to the 1600s in the state of New Hampshire, and nobody, and that's my husband's family's name. Right. I mean, our kids can all be sons of the Revolution, and, you know, any of the female granddaughters can be daughters of the American Revolution. I will not allow anybody to sully that name.
Very good. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
Well, our first candidate for governor here, we'll try to get all four of them, I hope.
Okay.
And thanks very much. Again, the website is silly.
JackieSilly.com.
JackieSilly.com. Couldn't be easier. Thank you very much for being with us. And I think this song can apply to you. Wasn't born to follow. Thanks very much.
Nice. Nice.
So I'd rather go and journey where the diamond crescent's glowing, and run across the valley beneath the sacred mountain, and wander through the forest where the trees have leaves of prisms and break the light in colors that no one knows the names of. When it's time, I'll go and wait beside a legendary fountain till I see your form reflected in its clear and jeweled waters. And if you think I'm ready, you may lead me to the chasm where the rivers of our vision flow into one another. Surely know I wasn't born to follow.